From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. One of the big political showdowns of 2021 is happening right now in Georgia. The Senate runoffs pit Republicans David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler against Democrats John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock. The prize could be monumental for Democrats. If they win the seats, they will control the Senate and the House with Joe Biden as president. NPR's Sarah McCammon is in Dalton, Georgia, about 90 miles north of Atlanta. It's where President Trump held a rally last night. Hey, Sarah.
Hi there.
What's it like where you are right now with so much power in the balance?
Well, there is just so much attention on Georgia right now. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent on these runoff races because everyone's well aware of the stakes here. We're seeing activists and volunteers all over the state, many from out of state, working on get out the vote operations for both parties' candidates, and also major surrogates in the form of President Trump, President-elect Biden, and others over the past few days. Because as we know, this runoff really is about so much more than Georgia.
You attended President Trump's rally last night, and during that rally, the president continued to claim there was fraud in the November election, which is not true. And then there's that remarkable phone call the president made trying to convince Georgia's Secretary of State to find votes for him. What are you hearing from people there about it?
Well, Republican voters, or at least Trump supporters, are very much taking their cues from the president. I spoke to Colette Devine over the weekend at a rally, really a prayer march outside the Georgia State Capitol in Atlanta. She'd come from her home in North Georgia to this event, which was organized by one of these out-of-state groups. And like so many conservative voters I've met in the last few days, she has fully absorbed the message coming from President Trump and many other Republicans. Again, despite the many repudiations of this idea of election fraud by the courts and by Republican elections officials, she believes the conspiracy theories about voter fraud, and she says she's concerned about what she is convinced are stolen elections.
The fact that Americans don't have the freedom to vote the way they want to, it has to be stolen.
Do you think you'll be able to trust whatever happens on Tuesday?
No, absolutely not. Anyway,
if Loeffler and Perdue win, do you think will you believe that? I assume that's who you support.
Why wouldn't we? I mean, why shouldn't I? Because we don't steal, we don't cheat, we don't lie.
You mean Republicans don't?
This Republican doesn't.
And Tanya, she's not alone. I mean, every Republican I've spoken to this weekend at rallies and get out the vote events has told me they are at minimum skeptical, even of their own Republican Secretary of State and governor, who have affirmed the validity of this election after three vote counts here in Georgia, all of which found that Biden was the winner. Now, certainly not all Republicans are buying that message from the president, most notably some top officials here in the state. But there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation, and it is being absorbed, at least by the party's base, to a large degree.
Yes, this woman you spoke with was very strong in her convictions. I mean, Democrats and Republicans are using all of these different strategies to get out the vote. But how are those efforts really playing out in these final hours when you have folks like the woman you spoke to who obviously nothing will change her mind?
Right. So Republicans have acknowledged they don't have the same kind of turnout operation that Democrats have been lauded for. Think of Stacey Abrams and other activists who've employed this very sophisticated get-out-the-vote strategy that includes door-knocking and texting and targeted voter outreach and education. That worked really well for Biden, won him a narrow victory in November, but the first victory for a Democrat in a presidential race here in almost 30 years. And Democrats are hoping that works for them in this runoff. Republicans, meanwhile, have also been canvassing, making a big final push. I've talked to folks from a couple of conservative Christian groups who are knocking doors in the past few days. And they especially need to turn out voters in the red rural areas outside of Atlanta where Republican support is strongest. So that's likely why President Trump chose rural Northwest Georgia to make his last big pitch to voters last night.
You know, one more thing, Sarah, I only have about 30 seconds with you, but this pandemic, so many people have descended on the state for these runoffs. Has concern for the rise in coronavirus changed the way people are campaigning and moving through Dalton today?
It has, and this is an area where you see the partisan divide once again. I mean, I've been at at events for both parties, and you see everyone masked at Democratic events, and many, many people, if not most people, unmasked at Republican events. Fortunately, these are outside. But there is not a mask mandate in Georgia. It's just encouraged. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of almost tell where people fall politically based on masks.
Well, Sarah, stay safe. That's NPR's Sarah McCammon reporting from Georgia.
Thank you.
Well, tomorrow, a group of Republican lawmakers will try to prop up President Trump's baseless claims of election fraud by challenging Joe Biden's victory when Congress meets to formally certify the Electoral College vote. Vice President Mike Pence is expected to preside over the joint session. And last night at that rally in Georgia, Trump put pressure on Pence to go beyond his ceremonial role and do something to overturn the election.
I hope that our great vice president comes through for us. He's a great guy. Of course, if he doesn't come through, I won't like him quite as much.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, joins us now. And Julian, let's just start with the historical precedent here. What's supposed to happen tomorrow?
Well, it's always a historic event, but it's pretty pro forma normally. Lawmakers from the House and Senate, they meet in the House chamber. The vice president presides over this process, and the votes from the states are brought in these special boxes. And the vice president opens the sealed certificates submitted by each state, and they are read out loud by bipartisan tellers who are appointed by the House and Senate. And usually it goes pretty quickly, and we have the results of the election.
Well, and this is why Mike Pence is in a tough spot. This morning, President Trump tweeted a false statement. I'm going to say it again, a false statement that the vice president has the power to reject fraudulently chosen electors tomorrow. So keep that in mind. Here's Pence campaigning in Georgia yesterday.
You know, I know we all got our doubts about the last election. And I want to assure you, I share the concerns of millions of Americans about voting irregularities. And I promise you, come this Wednesday, we'll have our day in Congress.
All right, so what's the likelihood that Mike Pence does anything other than what you just described, announce the election results tomorrow as he is required to do?
Well, we know there's going to be objections, which sets up a process where the members go to a private meeting and review the objections and vote about whether they are legitimate or not. But we're still expecting Vice President Pence to finish the process and confirm that there are no challenges from the states. The states are sending agreed upon electors. The courts have rejected all challenges. So the assumption should be, and he's not in a tough spot to make this decision, that he will move forward with the process of voting in favor of this.
But he may be running for president in 4 years, and he may have to anger the president here himself by making this announcement publicly. What does it mean for him, at least politically, in terms of his future?
Well, it will put him at odds with a lot of members of the party who have either passively or actively supported this effort to overturn the election. But just because you face political pressure like that is not a reason to go through with something that's fundamentally anti-democratic. But you're right in that if he's thinking of 2024, he's about to anger a lot of Republicans whose support he'll need.
Well, throughout U.S. history, as you've explained, the act of certifying this vote is pretty much been a formality, and there is no real likelihood that anywhere near enough votes are there to change the outcome of this vote. But can we just play devil's advocate for a moment here, Julian? What if Republicans controlled both chambers of Congress? How close would President Trump be to overturning this election through Congress, getting what he's been asking for?
Well, I can't predict the future or a different scenario than occurred, but based on the way that many leading Republicans, including party leaders, have supported this challenge, under unified government, you could imagine this being a much more serious threat. And that when the legislators went back into those private discussions, that they might support a challenge like this. And I think that's the state of the Republican Party in 2020, and the post-election period has revealed this quite clearly. So I don't think that could be discounted.
Yeah. Well, here's how Vice President Al Gore handled the certification 20 years ago when he lost the race to George W. Bush after the Supreme Court stopped a recount in Florida. Let's listen.
May God bless our new president and our new vice president, and may God bless the United States of America.
So that was not an easy moment for him. He had to gavel down members of his own party who tried to object and who ultimately walked out of the chamber in protest. How do you think history will look back on what happens tomorrow and really what's happened since this year's election?
I don't think it will look back favorably at where the Republican Party has moved. As I said, this is an anti-democratic agenda right now. And I don't think the way that the Republican Party, not just President Trump, has acted in the last few weeks will be looked upon well. The question will be, does the party change? Does it move beyond where it is today? Or is it so rooted in these kinds of tactics that it's just not going to enter a new era anytime soon?
Julian Zelizer, historian at Princeton University, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Britain has gone into full lockdown until February in response to a new, more highly contagious strain of the coronavirus. All schools and colleges are closed. People are ordered to stay inside their homes except for trips to the doctor or to the grocery store. Here's Prime Minister Boris Johnson announcing the measures yesterday.
With most of the country already under extreme measures, it's clear that we need to do more together to bring this new variant under control while our vaccines are rolled out.
Cases of that variant have been confirmed in four U.S. states, including New York, yesterday. But is the U.S. taking this new strain of the virus seriously enough? I want to bring in Dr. Angela Rasmussen, a virologist with Georgetown University. Dr. Rasmussen, welcome. And what do you think about that question I just posed? Are we taking it seriously enough?
So I think we are and we aren't at the same time. I think that we are in the sense that we have been alarmed by the emergence of this variant. We're asking the right questions, such as will the vaccines work against it? And we're beginning to do the types of research that will answer that question. We're also focusing more on at least acknowledging that we're not doing enough genomic surveillance, and that's why we haven't detected it until after it was already detected in the UK, where they do have a very robust genomic surveillance program. So that's all well and good, but I think that we're not taking it seriously enough and that we're not addressing how we can prevent becoming infected with this variant now. And that is really acknowledging the fact that this variant may be more transmissible, but it's not being transmitted by some new route of exposure. The same measures that we should be applying to reduce transmission of any variant of SARS coronavirus 2 also apply to this. So I think we're really missing an opportunity to double down on our message of exposure risk reduction by wearing masks, physically distancing, increasing ventilation, et cetera.
I think this is important, and it can also be confusing to people because we're hearing that the variant may be more contagious, not necessarily more deadly, but more contagious. But what does that mean exactly? Does that mean that if I'm in the presence of an infected person, the window of time to get infected is different? Does that mean that if I'm outdoors with an infected person, it would be easier to get? I mean, what does more contagious actually mean?
So right now, we can't answer that question because we actually don't know the mechanism by which it is more transmissible, just that it is. The reason we know that it is more transmissible is that very, very rapidly, it essentially outcompeted all the other variants that were circulating in a given area in the UK. And this was so rapid, in fact, that it really can't be explained by just there was more of this virus. It seems to have some sort of competitive advantage for spreading in a population. But we don't know exactly what gives it that competitive advantage. And it could be a number of different things. It could be that people who are infected are shedding more virus. It could be that the virus is persisting in the environment for a longer period of time. The virus particles are more stable. It could be that it's more efficient at infecting cells. We just don't know. And we're doing the research to determine that right now. But at least, you know, it's very important to note that this virus is less pathogenic, or it's as pathogenic as any other variant. It's not more virulent than anything else circulating, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to cause fewer deaths, because right now our healthcare system is really stretched to its breaking point. So if we have a variant that's even more transmissible, that's going to mean more SARS coronavirus 2 cases. That's going to mean more people in the hospital. Ultimately, that's going to mean more people dying of COVID, but it's also potentially going to mean more people dying of other things when they can't seek medical care, they can't access the medical care that they might need for a heart attack or a car accident, because our healthcare right. system is overwhelmed.
So thank you for noting that. We've health officials have found the variant in California, Colorado, Florida, now New York, as I said. Should we just assume, though, that it is far more widespread at this point across the country?
I think that we should. And again, the reason that we haven't detected this is not because it's, you know, it was in the UK and then it got brought over here. It may have been here even before it was in the UK. We just actually don't know, because we're not doing enough genomic surveillance. And what that means is we're not sequencing enough of the viruses from the various cases that are popping up in the US.
And in a perfect world, how would that process even work?
So in the UK, how this works is they sequence about 10% of the viruses that are causing new cases of SARS coronavirus 2. And that's because they have dedicated funding to do that type of genomic surveillance. We don't have that dedicated funding, at least not in large quantities in a national network around the country. So really, when viruses get sequenced here, it's because somebody has some extra money to do that, or because they have a small grant to sequence just the viruses that are spreading within that community. Overall, as I said, the UK sequences about 10% of the viruses that they have. We sequence about 0.3%, so considerably fewer. I think what people should understand about this is that genomic surveillance is not just useful for detecting these new variants early, but that's going to be even more important as we roll out the vaccine to more people, because we will really need to know if any variants are emerging that might potentially be able to evade immunity produced by the vaccines.
Absolutely. Dr. Angela Rasmussen, a virologist with Georgetown University, thank you very much for your insights.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Peter.
A story now about an element we don't think much about, but plays a huge role in our lives. It's lithium, used for decades in everything from antidepressant medications to ceramics. Today, it's being used to harvest in mass quantities for electric vehicles and renewable energy storage. That's because lithium has a high energy density. It can hold a great deal of power in a small amount of space. And there's only one lithium mine in the U.S. right now. It's in Nevada. And as Noah Glick from member station KUNR reports, it won't be the only one for long.
In the early 1990s, a consumer product gave lithium a big boost.
That's why we created America's most popular camcorder, the Handycam, from Sony.
The Sony Handycam was the first commercial product to use lithium-ion batteries. Today, the technology powers our laptops, smartphones, and now electric vehicles and homes. There are estimates that the lithium-ion battery market could reach more than $100 billion by 2027. Much of that growth can be attributed to the meteoric rise of electric vehicles, thanks in large part to Tesla and its CEO, Elon Musk.
Welcome to the Cybertruck unveil.
So just what is lithium really worth? Specifically, lithium carbonate, the industrial chemical used to make batteries. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, the average price is $13,000 per metric ton. And there are millions of tons of lithium in Nevada.
We're developing one of the world's largest lithium deposits.
That's Alexei Zavodsky, the CEO of Lithium Nevada. He's talking about his company's Thacker Pass mining project in rural Humboldt County. The lithium there is embedded in clay rather than hard rock, so the company had to invent its own process to extract the material. But Zavodsky says the investment is worth it.
The deposit is big enough to justify developing its own process. We have over 40 years of mine life here supplying the entire U.S. demand.
The company estimates that once the mine is fully operational later this decade, it'll supply a quarter of the world's demand for lithium. But first, the raw lithium needs to be converted into lithium carbonate, so the company is also building a processing plant on site. Rich Perry is the former state administrator of Nevada's mining industry.
Major capital, you know, expenditures to build plants like that would be game changers for Nevada.
If all goes well, Lithium Nevada's operations are expected to generate more than $75 million in new tax revenue for the state, in addition to an estimated $1.1 billion in overall economic impact. Nevada already has the world's largest lithium-ion battery plant, the Tesla Gigafactory, and with more lithium mines and a new processing plant, Perry says the state could come out ahead.
If we could produce it from the ground and then make the battery here, we would get the value of the chain there, plus we would reduce our risk from supply chain disruption.
There's also the promise of jobs. Jan Morrison is the economic development officer for the Northeastern Nevada Regional Development Authority. She says the economic potential for the community is phenomenal, but
what gets you really excited is what it does for our kids.
Morrison says lithium mining is high-tech and high-paying, and she's hopeful young people here will stay closer to home instead of moving to places like Silicon Valley for work.
Jobs and careers that normally you wouldn't think somebody in the rural area would be exposed to, this is going to be secondary nature to them. They'll have an advantage of these types of careers by being where these types of companies are.
Well, originally I was thinking, well, lithium, that's great. We all need to be doing our part. But then once I found out about the project, I'm horrified by it.
That's Edward Bartell. He runs a ranch nearby, and his biggest concern about the mine is the amount of chemicals it will use. According to the mining company's own estimates, the process would create nearly 6,000 tons of sulfuric acid a day when it reaches full production. It could also lead to serious health effects if any of that material were to leach out into the air or ground, or if there was an accident during transportation.
I mean, it's not like we're just hauling lumber or something. It's pretty dangerous chemicals that are going to be hauled up and down the road. So if there's an accident or something, that could potentially impact people.
And then there's the fuel side of it. The company will consume more than 26,000 gallons of diesel fuel every day, which contributes to pollution and disease. Striking that balance of acquiring a needed resource for renewable energy with potential negative environmental effects processing lithium is a battle currently underway in Nevada. For Here and Now, I'm Noah Glick in Reno.
Iran began the new year with a bang by seizing a South Korean oil tanker. The country's leaders then announced that they're boosting nuclear fuel enrichment in defiance of a 2015 deal that the Trump administration pulled out of. And just today, Iran asked Interpol to arrest President Trump for last year's drone strike on a top Iranian official. Joining us for more is NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Tanya.
It's been 1 year since the U.S. killed General Qasem Soleimani. Now Iran wants Interpol to arrest Donald Trump. Your thoughts on this move?
Well, it's symbolic. This is not going to happen. Iran did this before several months ago, in the middle of last year. They're asking for almost 50 U.S. officials. But what's important to understand here is that the Trump administration has waged this maximum pressure campaign against Iran throughout Trump's 4 years in office. And now what we're seeing is this could be seen as one part of Iran's effort to wage its own pressure campaign against the U.S. And maybe even more broadly, the international community at a moment when the U.S. is getting ready for a presidential transition.
Mm-hmm. South Korea also announced today that they'll dispatch a delegation to Iran after Iran seized one of its oil tankers. What's going on there?
Right. So Iran seized this oil tanker on Monday as it was going through the Strait of Hormuz. That's the waterway that's the entrance and exit to the Persian Gulf. Now, Iran claims that this was for pollution violations. But there's a very strong suspicion that the real reason Iran is doing this is it wants South Korea to hand over $7 billion. Now, South Korea has been withholding this money for Iranian oil that it bought because of the broader U.S. sanctions. The U.S. is not only sanctioning Iran itself, it's asked for other countries to go along with these sanctions. Iran is in very bad financial shape. It desperately needs this money. And so it would seem this is an attempt to strengthen its economy, and even reports that Iran wants this money to pay for COVID vaccines.
Iran also announced that it's going to enrich uranium to a higher level, though still not to the weapons-grade level. How significant is this?
Well, it is significant. Iran is allowed to enrich a limited amount of uranium to about 4% to run nuclear power plants. But now it's saying it's enriching up to 20%. Now, this could be used for medical research, but this is clearly a move to press for these greater sanctions relief and saying it wants some action taken here. It would need to go all the way up to 90% to have weapons-grade uranium, and there's no indication that's going to happen right now. But Iran, again, is trying to send a very clear signal that it's going to be very aggressive and assertive at this moment.
Mm-hmm. I have about 30 seconds with you. U.S.-Iran relations hit a low point during this Trump administration. So what are you expecting from the incoming Biden administration?
We're certainly expecting a different approach. President-elect Biden says he's willing to go back to the 2015 nuclear deal if Iran is going to go back to the same restrictions that were in place at the beginning. But it's not 2015. And what we're hearing is both sides might talk about a possible freeze. And then there would need to be some negotiations to go back and get things on track. But that's not going to be easy. We see this pressure campaign from Iran. It'll be a difficult challenge for the Biden administration.
NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie, as always, thank you.
My pleasure.
When President-elect Joe Biden picked Tom Vilsack to head the U.S. Department of Agriculture, many black farmers were outraged. The former governor of Iowa was ag secretary during the Obama administration, and black farmers said he did nothing to undo decades of racial injustice and discrimination at the department. This time around, Vilsack appears to be more aware of the political moment, and he's already spoken with black farmers and promised to promote policy that's fair and equitable. John Boyd Jr., a farmer from Virginia and president of the National Black Farmers Association, joins us now. John, you've spoken with Vilsack recently. Were you satisfied?
We're going to have to wait and see what happens. You know, there's a confirmation process that the secretary is going to have to go through. For me, as a leader, I'm very concerned to see what the cabinet makeup of USDA rolls out to be. We need people of color and people of color who care. I think that's vitally important, not just a black face or a Hispanic face or a woman. We need people who care about these issues, because for far too long, we've been left out of the farm subsidy programs, the lending programs, all of these programs that USDA has to help farmers. We've been absent for a very, very long time, and we need to improve those numbers of participation so that we can compete and stay on the farm.
Can you explain the history there a little bit, why it is that black farmers have been left out for a long time now in the U.S. government? If you look at a century ago in 1920, black farmers owned 14% of all farms in this country. Today, it is down to 1.6% of all farms. What's going on? I mean, is it just pure racism at the USDA denying black farmers the same benefits they're given? Yeah?
Yes. The one word answer is yes. And the more elaborate answer is we haven't been getting the programs. My own personal self, you know, who faced discrimination for a very long time at USDA, where the person who was making loans to black farmers in our county would only see us on Wednesday, where it took 370 plus days to process a black farm loan request and less than 30 days to process a white farmer's loan request here in my own county of Mecklenburg County, Virginia. That's the kind of discrimination that I faced, where this person spat on me, tore my application up and tossed it in the trash can, and would ideally sleep during the application period. And I would wait for him to wake up. I was in such desperate need for a farm operating loan. That's the type of discrimination that black farmers have been experiencing at the hands of the government. The very people who were supposed to give us a hand up was the very same agency that almost put us out of business and drove us into almost to extinction based on the numbers.
And what is the consequence then of that, of so many years of discrimination, of losing those farms? Because I can imagine it would be challenging for the next generation to take up farming if you didn't grow up in a farm or if your family gave up the land.
They took away our history. And the ability to own land is the first step to freedom, was what my grandfather Thomas Boyd taught me as a 9-year-old little boy. If you want to be free, you need to own some land. Land is the most powerful element you can possess. The government took away our freedom to farm by not lending us money the way that they do white farmers. So they took away our history and our heritage. And when you take away a man's farm, you've broken his spirit. It's not like working at McDonald's or some of these local companies where you just apply for another job and take another job. When you take away that person's farm, you're taking away his livelihood, his history. All of these things leave when you lose your farm.
Well, Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey says he plans to try to help you, right? He wants to reintroduce the Justice for Black Farmers Act. It would fund agriculture programs at historically black colleges and universities. It would create a civil rights oversight board to investigate reports of discrimination in the Department of Agriculture, which we've touched on a little bit here. What do you think? Would those policies work? I mean, what would work to get you and other black farmers back where you need to be?
Well, one of the things that that bill does address is the land issue that we just spoke about. And that's the most important tool. It gives us the ability to buy and purchase land the way that we really haven't had that opportunity. So if you want to turn around the trend, the first thing you have to do is make the monies readily available so that we can apply for these loans and buy land. And farming will look enticing for the next generation. I have two young men, and neither has said to me, "Hey, Daddy, I want to be a farmer just like you. Show me from A to Z." And it's because they watched me struggle so very long to hold on to the family land and hold on to the farm. And if they want the next generation of farmers, black farmers, that is, they have to open up the purse strings and find a way to let us be a part of American farming fabric where we can compete. And that's what we want to do. We want to compete. We don't want anybody to give us anything. So, and we're not lazy. Those things are a myth. I work 7 days a week. And I've been working 7 days a week since 1983, and I have no problem with working. The problem I have with access to credit, we have access to credit issues at USDA, we have them at the banks, and we have them at the equipment companies such as John Deere and others who treated black farmers very, very badly.
So here's what I want to understand, John Boyd, is will Tom Vilsack be the person to get you there? I mean, when it comes time to vote in the Senate to confirm him or not, what do you want to see? Does he deserve the job?
Well, I told the President-elect Biden that we needed new blood and new leadership at USDA. So Secretary Vilsack is a new blood. He is a new leadership. And I told him on the phone, you're going to have to reinvent yourself. He should come out and support the Booker bill. He needs to appoint people that are sensitive to the needs of black farmers and not big agriculture. We need people that are sensitive to the needs of black and other small scale farmers, Native American farmers, women, Hispanics, and make sure that we are part of the USDA. And the first thing he has to do is announce that USDA is open for business for black farmers and put a halt on farm foreclosures and announce a plan of action to resolve the backlog of complaints, civil rights complaints, for black farmers. He's got to prove himself.
Well, those are the politics, and I'm sure you'd rather not be talking to me about the politics. You'd probably rather be talking to me about the soybeans that you're growing, the corn, the wheat, beef cattle that you're raising. Just tell me about that really quickly. How is the farming business for you? How are the crops doing this year?
I checked the markets, and soybeans are about $14 a bushel, which ain't half bad. And I do believe it's because the industry, the whole agriculture industry, wanted to see a change in leadership from President Trump. The crops are, it's been a challenge due to the climate change. Right now it's raining and I should be finishing up harvesting soybeans. So it's been a challenge, and the pandemic, although my farm seems to be a pretty secure place, it's not a bad place to be, but I still have to purchase seed and lime and diesel fuel and parts. So I still have to intermingle with my local township. So it's really changed the way that farming is done. So we're going to have to adapt as farmers and find ways to still compete, even with the midst of the virus.
Well, John Boyd Jr., I know if anybody is a busy busy man. It is you, a farmer in Virginia, also founder of the National Black Farmers Association. Thanks for taking some time out of your day to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And let's take a minute now to mark an anniversary. 41 years ago today, a hip-hop single hit Billboard's top 40 for the first time ever.
Now what you hear is not a test. I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet. You see,
the Sugar Hill Gang's Rapper's Delight. Big Bank Hank, the group's leader, was discovered in the Crispy Crust Pizza Shop in New Jersey when the head of an independent record company wandered in and heard him rapping to himself. He talked about it in an interview on Jaquan.com.
I was helping make pizza at the shop, and a woman by the name of Sylvia Robinson came to the pizza shop, and they asked me, did I want to make a record? Picture this, I'm in a pizza shop full of dough, flour all over me, and I'm going to audition to make a record. So I go into the back of her son's 98, and they have a cassette in the car, and I'm rapping along with the track. And she really enjoyed it. She said, okay, I'm going to use you on the record. And a week later, we did it. It was done in one take.
Big Bank Hank died in 2014 at the age of 58. His music lives on. You're listening to Here and Now.
Over the course of 9 months, Russian hackers infiltrated the systems of 250 businesses and federal agencies, including Amazon, Microsoft, even the Department of Homeland Security. That's according to a recent report from the New York Times. This discovery means this hack could be substantially more widespread and dangerous than initially thought. David Sanger broke this story. He's a New York Times national security correspondent and author of The Perfect Weapon, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Great to be with you.
So the theory is that Russia was able to insert code into the network management software company SolarWinds to gain access to government and private networks. Can you explain how they were able to do that?
Sure. And remember that SolarWinds is the access that we understand best right now, but we have no reason to believe that that was their only way into the systems. Mm. So SolarWinds is a piece of software that's sort of deep in the steamworks of the way companies and government agencies run their networks. It literally makes network management software. So, you know, if you were NPR and you were worried about whether or not too many people would come online at one time and how you would manage the traffic, software like the kind that SolarWinds makes would be useful. We use it at the New York Times. What they did was get into what was a pretty poor security system within SolarWinds and insert code into the updates that SolarWinds pushes out to its customers. Now, this was a pretty brilliant thing to do because rather than try to break into the Pentagon or into the Commerce Department or the Treasury Department or the Los Alamos National Labs and so forth, mm-hmm. all users of SolarWinds products, what they were doing was having SolarWinds basically take them in and take them in with an update that's very similar to what you do when you update your cell phone.
Okay, wow. You and your colleagues spoke with several key players investigating this breach, and you write that 3 weeks into this discovery, they're still trying to figure out whether this was a case of espionage or something more sinister. What is the prevailing thought?
Well, they don't know yet. Espionage, for sure. We've found scores of cases in which the Russians went in and pulled data out of the systems. The big question is, did they insert backdoors in those systems? Did they insert code that could be used to disable those systems later on? Did they get into actual functional utilities? And, of course, this is something the United States has done to other countries before. It was essentially a supply chain kind of attack that enabled the U.S. to do the cyber attack on Iran's nuclear centrifuges a decade ago. So we know that that kind of additional malicious work can be done.
Can you Can you define for us what you mean when you say taking advantage of the supply chain? Because that's what happened in this case with SolarWinds. If you can break it down in layman's terms.
Sure. So think about it in terms of the physical world. If you were going to go to try to disable some American tanks, you know, used by the military, would you go into the base where they're stored? Well, you might, but you'd probably get caught. You might get shot. Would you go into the supplier of ball bearings for those tanks and try to flatten the sides of them? That would be a lot smarter way to get in and disable them. Software gives you the same opportunity.
Yeah. Why is it significant that the hackers use servers from within the United States? It seems to have impacted the National Security Agency's ability to actually detect these hacks.
Yeah, it's a really good point, Tanya. And the reason is that the NSA is a collector of foreign intelligence and is not allowed to operate inside the United States. The CIA is not allowed to operate in the United States. Only groups like the FBI or Homeland Security are permitted to do so. So by operating from inside American servers, making those servers the command and control system that the software beamed out to, they basically evaded the set of sensors that the NSA or other intelligence agencies in the U.S. Can use abroad, because they're simply not allowed to focus their operations inside the U.S.
David, we can take an hour to talk about this. I have so many questions for you, but I only have a minute left with you. I mean, how does this hack impact everyday Americans' lives? Why is it important that we know about this?
It's important we know about this because this is the new form of vulnerability that the United States has, and because cyber attacks have become the primary way that countries undercut each other's power. You know, we still tend to think in terms of nuclear confrontation with Russia and China and so forth. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is, you can't use nuclear weapons every day. You can use cyber weapons every day in a short of war way. And that's why.
David Sanger, New York Times national security correspondent, thank you so much for talking with us about this.
Great to be with you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.